Hello, everybody. Welcome to Topical Fever, episode 15. My name is David Parsons, and I am very glad, very happy that you're listening to the podcast. This week, I had a discussion with a couple of friends. One of them who has been on the show before, his name is Robin Blotnick. He's a activist and filmmaker, and one of the people behind the film The Hand That Feeds that I did an episode about a few weeks ago. The other is Andrew Bossi. I know him as Andy. Andy is a economics professor and also a guy with a great basement for playing video games and watching movies. And we certainly talk a lot about video games and movies in this episode. I wanted to talk mainly about World War II this week with Andy and Robin. World War II is part of my own personal DNA, I suppose, and war in general. When I was growing up, and I think it might still be there, actually, in my parents' house, there's a framed collection of photographs. It's three photos, one of my great-grandfather, one of my grandfather, and one of my father. And that lineage, all in their military uniforms, one for World War I, one for World War II, and one during the Vietnam era. And so that lineage was powerful in my family, although I did not join the military. It's kind of like, I feel a little bit like Lieutenant Dan, although I think for me, I didn't really feel the responsibility like Lieutenant Dan. I think the only thing I have in common with Lieutenant Dan is maybe we both don't like ice cream, and maybe a general skepticism about religion. But other than that, I didn't go to war, and I ended up being rather anti-war in my orientation, and that actually drove a lot of what I ended up studying and writing about in graduate school and beyond. So I brought Andy and Robin in to talk a little bit about what World War II means for quote-unquote our generation of post-baby boomers who are still kind of in the wake, living in the wake of that war, living in the wake of Vietnam and other wars, and how that's kind of functioned in our lives, both as I guess, scholars and thinkers and that kind of stuff, but also as just people who like play video games like Call of Duty and who grew up playing G.I. Joe and that kind of stuff. So G.I. Joe and He-Man and a lot of other stuff comes up in this discussion, and we had a good time. I think Andy's someone who I get a kick out of intellectually because he challenges my need to sometimes simplify things. I really want to see World War II as a major cultural development, as a major kind of social and even psychological event. But Andy wants to see the details, and so he constantly is challenging my need to reduce things to their essences, and I really appreciate that challenge. So we had a good time in this conversation. I hope you enjoy this episode. This is me, Andy, and Robin talking about World War II. I got the Wikipedia page up for World War II, so we're ready to go. And actually, the Wikipedia page for World War II is pretty intense. It's like,
oh yeah, I bet it's like 40 pages long.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how to measure 40 pages on a Wikipedia page, but it's pretty big. It's like almost as big as the page for Wario from Mario Kart. We actually found my friends and I a long time ago found that Wario had a Wikipedia page, and it was fucking huge. It was like, I'm serious, like our joke was that it was like nearly as big as the civil rights movement, or almost as big as the civil rights movement. It was just like a profile of Wario, like where he's from, like his history with Mario, which is like a long, like Lord of the Rings type thing, and like there's a Waluigi. Did you know that? There's a Waluigi.
That doesn't flow as well as Wario.
No.
Waluigi.
Waluigi. Speaking of toys, I guess I wanted to ask if you guys listened. Did you guys play with G.I. Joes when you were a kid? Because I played with G.I. Joes a whole bunch.
Well, As I mentioned last time I was here, my parents are kind of hippies, so no. I had a secondhand Indiana Jones action figure, and I think that was my only toy growing up.
Wow. Did you play with wooden blocks and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
vegan like, toys?
Yeah. Your parents were hippies during the Depression?
I played in the woods. I played with dirt.
I was just telling Claudia this morning that my neighbors were kind of those weird Christians that don't like Harry Potter and don't like witchcraft or anything like supernatural, Lord of the Rings included, and they wouldn't let their kids play with He-Man, and I was really into He-Man, and so they wouldn't, and they ended up like really encouraging their kids to play with G.I. Joes over He-Man, which is like an amazing, because they were Christians. Because
G.I. Joe is fully clothed.
Right, and he doesn't do any of that spooky, supernatural, witchcraft type of shit.
Yeah, I mean,
He just like kills for the USA.
Right, He-Man's powers come from the occult.
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, oh, the Castle of Grayskull. Yeah.
Right, yeah, first of all, right, that's pretty satanic.
Yep. And yeah, I know there are a lot of things I think to be disturbed about He-Man. But Andy, did you play with G.I. Joe?
I was not a G.I. Joe kid. I was a He-Man kid like yourself.
Really? You didn't play with G.I. Joes at all?
I had a couple, but like we really, really focused on He-Man.
The reason I bring it up is because when I was thinking about talking about World War II, I was thinking about the fact that I played with G.I. Joes as a kid. I mean, I wasn't like super patriotic about it, but I had like some. You can turn the AC off.
Yeah, so we can swelter.
That's a lot better.
not
really.
Temperature-wise,
not really,
but sound-wise.
With G.I. Joes, because I played with them as a kid, it was totally uncritical. It was just like, well, this is what the culture is, and this is what you play with. And they were like Hasbro commercials that were like, get the new G.I. Joe. Bridgemaker. I had this awesome like vehicle. It was like a Jeep with a bridge that
familiar.
Like you
press,
it clicked on, and then the it made a bridge and the car went over it. All that stuff was really cool, but I didn't realize that it was part of like if you read, there's a book called The End of Victory Culture by Tom Englehart. It's a book that's about like World War II, post World War II culture, and that G.I. Joe during the 1980s was part of like a total reappropriation of what war was by the Reagan administration, or in the context of the Reagan administration. It was like G.I. Joe was popular in the 50s and 60s, and then when Vietnam happened, they quit manufacturing G.I. Joes. And during the 1970s, there was a kind of like pacifist era. It was like tasteless to give your kids toys. This is the era that Robin was raised in. But not everyone was into that. And eventually, by the time you get to the 1980s, Reagan administration is kind of remaking the idea of war and almost like, I mean, almost kind of renormalizing the world or the Americans to war, and using kids especially as like the fodder for that. To me, it's like a really sadistic thing, because I grew up like having a totally unquestioning attitude towards the American military because of the G.I. Joe TV show and the G.I. Joe toys, and the idea that because we weren't doing like I didn't know anything about geopolitics back then. The only thing I knew was that Libyans were bad. Like, do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember. I think our lifetimes trace the ups and downs of Gaddafi.
Yeah, like,
were Libyans the villains in Iron Eagle?
Yes, Libyans and Back to the Future. If you remember, like Back to the Future was the only place where Doc could get plutonium was from the Libyans, who were like obviously terrorists, and he was just terrified of them. And I just remember being terrified along with Doc and thinking like, oh, the Libyans are like some alien culture that are going to come. And when they showed up in the mall parking lot in the middle of the night, they were horrifying. They had like machine guns. One had a rocket launcher, that like 1980s like Rambo rocket launcher. And they were just like, they had towels on their heads and were screaming, and like that's all they were. And that's what I remember about the 1980s.
And now we know that we do not have time travel because the Libyans gave up their nuclear program.
Yeah. Wow. That's a really important connection.
That
I think,
is
to
really
make.
Important.
So World War II.
I just want to say, yeah. Before we get to World War II though,
sure.
Bear in mind, right, that Cobra was a terrorist organization, right? It was.
Were they branded terrorists?
That says it in the introduction.
Yeah.
Says it right in the introduction. They're a non-state actor, right? They're committed. I mean, they're a typical comic book villain in the sense that their goal is world domination for no apparent reason.
Mm.
You know, like,
because they're I mean, they're anti-American, so they're anti like progress and humanity and democracy and all those things that Americans are.
It doesn't get that subtle though, right? Like they literally are just they just want to take over the world.
Yeah.
And G.I. Joe was constantly thwarting their attempts to take over the world.
Well, this terrorist thing was I mean, I guess I didn't realize this until during the Bush administration that Reagan declared a war on terror in like 1981 or 82. I'll have to go to Wikipedia for that. But either way, the phrase war on terror and the fight against terrorism has been much longer than 9/11, obviously. I don't think I'm blowing anyone's minds there.
Well, it was the 70s when the airline hijackings were at their sort of...
I remember that. And the Munich in 1972, right?
Yeah.
So... I guess I bring up the G.I. Joe stuff in the 1980s just to I guess bring up the idea that we all grew up in the shadow of World War II, and we all grew up in the shadow of Vietnam, and we grew up in the shadow of all this shit that like we didn't know much about when we were kids. Like all that baggage was kind of like thrown upon us, and it, like now I'm looking back and saying starting to realize that there were like, I don't know, 70 or 80 years of ideology got kind of invested in the toys I was playing with when I was a kid. And that's a weird idea. But the idea of the story of World War II, I think that's a really important idea to take apart. Because here's the question I would put to you that I kind of bring up to my students a lot about World War II. Is like, was World War II about stopping the Nazis from doing the Holocaust?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Because that's a very common perception about what World War II was.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean,
like and I won't even say the Holocaust. I'll just say Nazis. Like, that's when you say, why did World War II happen? Nazis. And can you problematize that a little bit?
Yes, I will. I would love to problematize that for you. No, look, the only way to get the U.S. involved in the war was for the Japanese to attack the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
right? And that... the war from the beginning, and the only way you could justify it, the only way Roosevelt could even get everyone on board for it, was for it to be viewed as a defensive war.
Right.
It was viewed as a defensive war. It was viewed as a defensive war throughout the entire war.
And that's why, I mean, that's why every war has been sold in a sense, right? It's like, we have to, it's not, I mean, I don't think... I think it'd be rare to say you're being offensive, right? I mean, internally.
Well, that's actually what's weird about the German and Japanese.
Like, yeah.
They were able to be offensive, you know? Like, there was no pretext about the German and Japanese expansionary policies.
And this is something that they were, like, justifying within their own countries?
Right. I mean...
Like, the Germans were saying, like, look, we're going to take these lands because we're going to take the Sudetenland, for instance, because it belongs to us, essentially.
Right. Or we're going to take the Ukraine because those dirty Slavs are...
So how about taking Paris and London?
Well...
That's a bit more of, like, the Cobra world domination kind of thing,
well,
I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, with, you know...
Hitler did have a kind of Cobra element to him.
No. Well, yes. Right? He was definitely a real Cobra commander,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In that he really did seem dedicated to world domination, kind of for no reason.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I mean, you want to excuse
it's another
it
one of
way.
Those working backwards thing that we were talking about just now about before we started recording was about, like, people that make the argument that, like, well, the world's a better place without Saddam Hussein. And that becomes a justification for the Iraq war, which is, and for me, like, not only, like, logically problematic, but also just insane to kind of look at the end result as a justification for everything that led to that result. The reason I bring that up is because 75 million people died in World War II, and it's kind of weird to say, well, it was good though because we had to stop Hitler. And it's like, would Hitler have killed 75 million people though?
Oh, he totally would have.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Look, I'm
not suggesting like letting Hitler do whatever he wants, obviously. that's the trap of World War II. Go ahead. Because it's such a weird thing to be stuck in this story. Yeah.
To get back to excusing Hitler.
Yes.
You cut me off right as I said. You want to give him a certain... I said something to the effect of, well, you want to give him an excuse for having done what he did.
Right, right.
But what I just wanted to say there was, given sort of the colonial paradigm at the time, right? Like, it was a colonial war, and colonialism wasn't thought of in quite the same way
right,
as now.
Right, right.
Yeah, I just want to finish that sentence so that nobody's like, oh, you know. Who can blame Hitler?
Right, you were about to say he was a really good speaker.
Yeah, you made the trains run on time.
All right,
I don't want to
jump all over the place, but I want to talk about. I know you know a lot about the economic end of it. I've never really fully, I guess, understood or put into my mind into a narrative that locks down that I remember is what communism has to do with World War II, because it's rarely pitched to us, at least, as a communist story. But one of the things that you've mentioned to me before that kind of blew my mind. You impressed upon me how much the Soviets and the Russians see the defeat of Nazism as a part of their history and as like a bigger part of their history and as an actual kind of justification for Stalinism, like for that communism actually worked in defeating Nazism.
So first of all, the Russians view World War II, and they call it the Great Patriotic War, right? World War II is this, they repulsed this invasion, right? To the extent that we talk about the U.S. as, having been in the defensive war, you know, many, many, exponentially more, right? World War II was a defensive war.
Right, right.
The Russians, like, there was actually, you know, a huge invasion. And that, you know, Stalinism did accomplish this kind of crazy feat in that this relatively backwards, agricultural economy did not collapse in the face of what was an extraordinarily successful onslaught by the Germans.
And so, you're saying that they were able to mobilize militarily while they had a communist agrarian economy.
Right, exactly. There was lots of aid, although early in the war there wasn't, right? But I believe that
Wikipedia. Wikipedia.
Yeah, someone should Wikipedia this. The Germans invaded Russia in 1940, right? And the Normandy invasion didn't happen until... you're not going to look this up quickly enough.
Yeah, no
it
way.
It did not happen until...
It's a vast Wikipedia page.
1943, right? And so that the Russians...
Yes.
...by themselves essentially held back the German army, right? More successfully than the French did.
Is this
and the French, you know, economically and, you know, militarily actually...
I'm looking at 1941 as being the Axis attack on the USSR.
Okay, so 41.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they held out for several years.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the Leningrad thing that is... for those that don't know about the Battle of Leningrad, that's a great Wikipedia page.
Okay, let's push everything back. Okay.
Yeah.
So the Germans invade in 41,
right?
And D-Day is on June 6, 1944.
Right. So there's a huge...
Thank you, Google.
Yeah, there's a huge delay there in U.S. entry into... It seems like... how about this? Is this accurate to say that the United States got in on the war, like, very late as a way to, like, kind of mop up and take control of the post-war situation?
No.
No?
The Russians...
Why can't you let me believe that?
The Russians would not have been able to hold out indefinitely.
Mm.
And the Russians also were very fortunate to have had signed a non-aggression, or maybe... It was probably a non-aggression pact with the Japanese.
Okay.
Right? And so that had... right, and that actually sort of dictated the Japanese strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Very early in the war, there was a particular battle, and the Japanese got very nervous about ever attacking the Russians.
Right.
And so their strategy was to move south.
Mm.
Sooner or later, the Japanese would have, in the absence of having to fight a real Pacific War,
right,
which they wouldn't have had the U.S. not entered because they wiped out, you know, all of the British holdings, and most of the U.S. holdings, too. The Russians would have wound up sooner or later fighting a two-front war.
Mm.
And holding the line against the Germans is very different than trying to fight a two-front war with two different, in theory, successful.
Right. So, so then why did the United States get involved in World War II? Why did they move from an isolated, and why really? I know that that Pearl Harbor is the excuse, but I think it's clear that FDR and others in the administration wanted, and particularly the State Department, wanted to get involved in a much more advanced way. So why is that? Was that economic? Do you think there are economic components to that?
No, I think it was, I mean, not really my area of expertise, but yeah. I mean, Roosevelt just recognized the geopolitics of it.
Yeah.
Right? You can't have Europe controlled by the Nazis.
Right.
They're not going to stop with Europe.
Right.
You know, Cobra Commander is not going to stop with Europe.
Yeah.
They want world domination. I mean, there were also legitimate threats to the U.S. I mean, the Japanese also represented really legitimate threats. I mean, the Japanese were really the problem for the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
right? More so than the Germans were a particular problem for the U.S.
Right. The Pearl Harbor, from what I understand, is not notable for the amount of military casualties. It's more notable for the fact that the Japanese destroyed fleets of ships and airplanes that took a long time to rebuild.
Yeah, although the sort of saving grace of that was actually the aircraft carriers, and World War II is the first war when aircraft carriers become the dominant center of naval warfare. Those weren't around. And that was the Japanese hope, was to wipe out, the Pacific Fleet.
Right.
Because both the Germans and the Japanese, to a large extent, understood that they did not have the capacity to take on a full ally, particularly the U.S., right? I mean, you have to understand, at the time, the U.S. economy was basically twice as big as its next biggest economy fighting.
So once
the U.S. gets involved, it's over.
Yeah, yeah.
It becomes a war of attrition, and the U.S. can just hammer away.
That's why it seems like when I asked, did the U.S. get in on this when it was really kind of all settled? But it was actually the U.S. that settled it. Like, it was the U.S. entry into it that kind of made it over.
Right.
Like, well, it was over as soon as the U.S. got involved.
Yeah, I mean, like, in North Africa, for instance, the English were still holding up a brave front there with the, they're holding their own.
Yeah.
Right? The British economy could never really mobilize well enough on its own, but it was able to sort of ship some weapons to the Russians.
Right.
But without entry in the U.S., it was a much sort of more fair fight.
Yeah, yeah.
Between the powers. But once the U.S. comes in, it's over. And so what the Germans, and particularly in the Japanese, because the Japanese were sort of more interested in a war with the U.S., was they had to have a bunch of very quick victories.
Yeah.
Right? And if they did not, they had to basically get the U.S. to sue for peace as quickly as possible so that they could hold on to their gains. Sort of the plan backfires a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's also important to remember, actually, that Pearl Harbor wasn't an isolated incident.
There were other Pearl Harbors?
Well, it was part of a Japanese strategy.
Yeah.
Right? And so within...
It's very risk-like. I mean, Risk the board game.
Right, yeah,
speaking of games that trained us as children and normalized war, Risk taught me that all about, imperialism and not only imperialism, but why imperialism is good for me. I wanted to be like that. You win Risk by conquering the entire world. It teaches you how to be the Cobra Commander.
It teaches you how to be Cobra Commander.
It seems like, in a weird way, then... The fact that the United States was able, and I know this is a kind of like an urban legend, but I think I've actually read this that at the height of U.S. war production, the United States was able to was manufacturing an airplane every 5 minutes, and so the war really became a matter of like who was able. If it's really a war of attrition, it's really a matter of like who's able to produce more shit faster. And since the United States had become this like insane capitalist industrial superpower that was willing to mobilize its entire, basically its entire economic and political and social structures to fight the war, then we won. Then that's how the U.S. won. Like the U.S. won through its like. And what I'm saying is like it was through like the economic organization of capitalism. This is why World War II becomes like the justification for capitalism. In the same way that I guess I was kind of wanting to know if. the Russians' defeat of Nazis is considered justification for communism within their culture. It's really interesting to me that the World War II became like kind of an economic thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are a Russian who thinks fondly on Stalin, you think of World War II, right? You think of what he did to save the country from the Nazis.
And you don't think of the other elements of Stalin that are unsavory.
Well, yes. Although, in some ways, you can't disconnect the two, right? When the Soviets come to power, Russia's a completely agrarian, economy with a little bit of industry.
You're talking about right at the beginning of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah, 1917.
Yeah.
And then the Russians lose World War One, although because the communists, sign a peace treaty with the Germans.
Right.
And then by the time Stalin dies, they have a nuclear bomb.
Mm.
And like, if you at the cost of enormous, enormous amount of lives.
Right.
But if you are to think fondly on Stalin, right, then that is what you talk about. You talk about the ability of the Russians to repel a relatively fully industrialized economy like the Germans.
Right.
That's the function that Stalin... Whatever, right? That's the nostalgia for Stalin.
Right, right.
And
that still exists, as I understand, in Russia. Like, it's not prominent, but there's still there's a section of the population that's into that, right?
Well, the thing about that generation in Russia is
Stalin's in vogue among the left in a weird way, right? Is that right?
I have not been paying attention to Russia for quite some time.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible.
I'm just talking about, there's a clip in a movie about Slavoj Žižek where he has, a picture of Stalin in his house. And, the people making the movie are like, why do you have this? And he's just like, what? He's, a national hero. And, they're really, disturbed by the fact that he had it. And he was just kind of like, I'm a Stalinist. he was just kind of like, why is it even an issue that it's there?
All right. I'm not sure if we should take Žižek. What's in vogue among the left.
No, although, that's right.
True.
Point taken. But there are people that stand up for Stalin, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But you also,
if you hate capitalism, I think it's natural.
There are people who stand up for Hitler still. I mean, you can't.
You're always gonna have that. There's probably people out there that stand up for Cobra Commander too.
Yeah, there's a
they like it.
Element
they
of,
liked his they liked his like social and economic policies. They weren't really into the world domination part, but they admire what he was trying to do.
That always irritated me. It's exactly where they get the funding for for that standing army, standing terrorist army. From what I've seen, terrorist armies are pretty ragtag.
Yeah, the Cobra Commander has a really insane amount of technology, and they have they're pretty flashy.
Yeah,
now that I think about it.
Yeah, but terrorism is strictly a low-tech
business. Well, nowadays.
Yeah, post-Cobra Commander.
Yeah. I have a question about World War II.
Okay.
I think one of the first few times we hung out, we played Call of Duty at your house.
Yes.
Call of Duty. Robin, you've played Call of Duty, right?
Absolutely.
So
Robin has played a lot of Call of Duty.
So we've got three guys that all are kind of semi or full on radicals, right? Pacifists, people. I don't know if I would consider Andy a pacifist. I think you're.
I don't know if I.
You would describe yourself as a pacifist.
Yeah, I would not describe
myself as a pacifist. But you are from Maine.
Which yes. Okay. Not a warlike.
Those two things aren't connected. So how do you square that? Robin? How do you justify playing a video game where you reenact state murder? Let me put it in the bleakest terms possible.
How does it feel to call in a drone?
Yeah.
Right.
How do you sleep at night?
If you get three kills, you get to call in your own drone.
Because I hate war and I love those games.
I think that, as a man, it's in my biological nature to kill people with drones.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I can play at a fantasy of that, then I won't have to do it in real life.
Well, and that's that's kind of a beautiful thing because that's what modern masculinity is becoming. It's not a Teddy Roosevelt go out and, kill the savage with your bare hands. It's like I've got a really cool machine that I can just press a button. And, you know, they give medals of valor to guys that run drone stuff from like CIA bases in Florida. And like, that's really amazing that you could get a medal for bravery for pressing a button. But Andy, how do you justify playing Call of Duty?
It's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's overthinking it to, you know what? Honestly, particularly the World War II based Call of Duties, which is what the franchise sort of evolved out of. It was a bunch of Call of Duty.
I think we've stormed Normandy.
We have, at some point. They have definitely stormed
while like eating Doritos. You have no justification.
I have no justification. Yeah. Although I do want to say,
call it war porn?
I don't know.
It's so complicated because I mean, Call of Duty, I think is actually the engine is used to train military guys, right?
And well, like, the military also puts out its own first person shooter.
Can you get that?
Yeah, it's called. I don't remember exactly. It's called ARMA. ARAM is the abbreviation for it.
That's nuts.
There's actually this really great video game that was made off of it called World War Z, which would use the engine of ARMA.
But it has nothing to do with the zombie World War Z, right?
Sorry, it's not called World War Z. It's called
DayZ.
But it is a zombie-based game where you sort of just get dropped in this world of zombies and you have to survive it.
Right.
It's a really fun game. The violence of it can be desensitizing, but it can also, I also, and not to justify it, because I don't know if it can really be justified as anything but entertainment.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, I am totally willing to admit, having just played a couple of World War II video games, I would be the guy drowning, getting off the boat to storm Normandy.
Like, the guy that has like too much in his sack.
Yeah, and just
sinks right when he jumps in the
water.
The
guy on the boat who drops it down like 200 yards offshore, and I'll go charging in.
Yeah.
Like that, I fully recognize how horrible that is.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's taught you a little bit about like the nuts and bolts of war and how you would perhaps be a failure at it physically.
Well, there are fascinating aspects of it. Like, for instance, the way, an M1, which was the rifle, you know, the standard rifle of the infantry, they actually make it more or less... like a high, like accurate.
Yeah.
You know, like it's relatively hard to fire, you know.
Right.
I mean, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a video game, so it's all a fantasy.
But yeah.
Like, so that it's not as hard as it actually would be. I don't know. Look, we are basically, you know, this is a generational issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of playing with G.I. Joes, and we have permission to play G.I. Joes.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at, like, is that, I played with G.I. Joes. I did not grow up to be, like, a pro-war person. In fact, I guess being an anti-war person has probably animated a lot of my life and what I've chosen to do as a scholar and everything else. And it's like, it's not like those toys actually programmed me to be a warrior. Instead, they kind of programmed me to think about war, which is a kind of interesting element of it, because I also play Call of Duty. Or not regularly, but whenever I'm at your house, Andy, I play Call of Duty. And I don't really have a problem with it, but at the same time, it feels weird because I study war so much to like be actually like behind the eyes of a soldier in World War II doing that. It also makes me think of that dude that like went nuts in Norway and killed all those the anti-Islamic dude. You know what I'm talking about? And that guy was kind of a Nazi a little bit, and he used he played Call of Duty for like a year and a half just entirely to train, to be able to kill people.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, that's what they were saying about that the Newtown shooter, Adam
Lanza.
Lanza,
yeah,
was that he seemed to understand sort of basic military tactics in a way that you wouldn't unless you played video games.
Right?
Like the importance of reloading your clip.
Yeah, but right? I mean, like, you could probably learn that from something beyond just a video game.
Well, he could have just gone on the internet and bought the military, the manual that they give to infantry people, and he could have just read that, you know?
It's also weird. I mean, I never, whenever I hear people saying that, like, video games and rap music and stuff are the cause of violence, it's just, like, such a backwards, weird argument to make, because it seems like the violent impulse is there all the time. I mean, we're talking about World War II. It's like, When I go to the Wikipedia of World War II, it really is like an insane kind of document, because it's just it's striving for a very kind of like weird objectivity. Like one of the strangest Wikipedia pages you can go to is just the Wikipedia page for a human being. Because it's written like it's from an alien perspective. It's like a human being is a type of species that, you know, and World War II is kind of like that. Because listen to this. World War II, also known as the Second World War, was a global war that lasted from 1939 to 1945. It involved the vast majority of the world's nations, including all of the great powers, eventually forming two opposing military alliances, the Allies and the Axis. It's already like Lord of the Rings. It was the most widespread war in history, with more than 100 million people serving in military units from over 30 different countries. In a state of total war, the major participants placed their entire economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities at the service of the war effort. Erasing...
That's not totally accurate.
Okay, well, I want to hear that. Erasing the distinction between civilian and military resources. Marked, here's the fun stuff, marked by mass deaths of civilians, including the Holocaust and the only use of nuclear weapons in warfare. It resulted in 50 million to over 75 million fatalities. These deaths make World War II likely the deadliest conflict in human history. I mean, so we're talking about something that is this weird thing to live in the shadow of. And I feel like that something like that can't happen on the planet Earth without us living in the next maybe 100 years just kind of quivering from that. Does that make sense? Like that we're still in the aftershock of World War II?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't help but think about my own grandfather's experience when I play Call of Duty and just how insane it is that somebody I descended from actually did that
stuff. Well, he was in World War II.
Yeah.
Do you know what his experiences were?
I know that he was a ball turret gunner in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And that his plane was shot down and they managed to like restore the engine before it crashed.
Right.
And that he also would lead squadrons as a staff sergeant into...
Did he survive World War II?
Yeah.
Jesus.
He led squadrons into the Okinawa jungles.
Yeah.
To fight the Japanese and came back, and he was a hearing aid salesman.
Good Lord.
I mean, it's just such a...
Yeah, you know, such a weird just, like, dissonance.
Kind of go right into suburban life.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, my every Memorial Day growing up, my dad took me to the cemetery in Oxnard, California, to put flowers on and, like, clean the graves of my grandfathers, who were both my mom's dad and my dad's dad were in World War II, and my dad's dad was in Korea as well. And you're right, came back to suburban America and lived lives, and it's just hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah.
My grandfather actually had a heart attack while he was in Korea. There wasn't a lot of technology, so they just like sent a telegram to my grandma and said, your husband has had a heart attack, and he has to basically... Back then, the treatment for a heart attack was basically like lay down for a few months and see if it gets better. And so he just laid down and he was over there for like a year and a half with very little word from him. And my grandma got a pension of something like $11 a month, and rent was $5 a month. And I was like, you're talking about a really like different time. Because your rent was $5 a month. She had $6 left over. She could buy a chicken. And that would be about it, and try and make that chicken last for the kids while dad is over in Korea. Laying in bed in some VA hospital. It's really, really incredible, this era. And I guess these stories continue today. They're just not as much a part of our lives. I feel like war has been kind of extracted.
Well, that generation is also dying.
Yeah.
That generation is going to be gone pretty soon. You know?
Yeah.
Like, if you were 18 in 1940, like, you know, how old are you now? You're in your 90s, right?
Yes.
Did I do the math right?
Yeah, something like that. I think you're 412.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I get your point. But also the idea of war has changed. I mean, there's not a draft. There's not like a feeling that if there was a World War III, right now, how ready would everyone be? And I mean everyone, I mean the people that have never considered military service because it's not part of our lives in the same way that it was before. how many kids would be ready to go? I mean, I ask my students that all the time. I was like, if there was a draft and you were asked to go to Afghanistan right now, or you were asked to go to Syria right now, Would you be ready?
Put me in that drone control room.
Yeah, you're right. I don't really need to go physically. I can just play the video game of War.
I want to give you a hard time about that. I think those are very different conflicts.
Yeah.
Right? I think that there is a vast difference between World War II and Vietnam slash
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. I'm just talking about the concept of military service in American life is just kind of like not the same, right?
Well, first of all, I mean, there was actually conscription, right?
Yeah.
So the all-volunteer army emerges after after Vietnam.
Right.
Right. Before that, there was, you know, sort of forced conscription.
Sorry, I'm playing around to get my audio better. Okay.
Right. So, I mean, the whole thing is very different, which is that you could actually just be drafted.
Yeah. Right.
Forcibly drafted. Like.
I guess that's what I mean is that like people aren't as ready to go to war because it's not something that they actually are asked to think about often.
But I mean, I think that that's also functions as an ideological thing.
Yes.
Because no, we don't have to think about war.
Yeah.
Like we don't think about war. We don't think about veterans. You know, we don't think about anything. Right. The whole Afghan-Iraq conflict happened off stage.
Uh-huh.
We didn't experience it. There was no economic hardship associated with it, unlike other
wars. The people that fight the war are from the working class. I mean, the end of the draft was always unfair. The draft always allowed the middle class to get out of it in different ways. Everyone knows about college deferments, and that's just one example. There were a lot of different ways the middle class and upper class people could get out of the draft. And that's one of the reasons it was ended. It was considered unfair. But the effect of ending the draft has been that the working class tends to join the military more than any other because it's a job.
Yeah, there's like a weird justification for it now.
Like if you drive through the shitty areas of New York City, and I say shitty, I mean neighborhoods that are experiencing dramatic poverty. Some of the only things that are open, like the Armed Services Career Center.
Yeah.
Like, it's, like, the one option. We were just talking about this in the last episode of the War on Drugs with Justin, was that, like, when you live in neighborhoods like that, like, the only options, there are a few. And, like, there's crime, obviously, but there's then joining the NYPD, because they're always going to hire. Or joining the military. And so it's kind of a disturbing development in American economy. And that's post-war. That's post-war world, too.
Yeah, it is. It all serves these particular... I mean, that was what was sort of... I mean, World War II, everyone went.
Yeah.
But, like, again, there wasn't a...
Or you grew a garden in your backyard.
You know what I mean? A victory garden.
Right.
But, I mean, there just wasn't the same kind of cynicism about it.
Mm.
You know, like... I mean, there couldn't be. Vietnam, Afghanistan,
that's amazing that there's not cynicism about. I guess that's what trips me out the most about World War II is that there wasn't such cynicism about war in a war that killed I just read the stupid Wikipedia page, 75 million people, right? The most deadly conflict in human history, and we all found ways to feel good about it.
Well, part of it, I think you have to go back to Stalin.
Mm.
You know, the American left got behind the war.
Yeah.
And the international left got behind the war because for the most part, you know, they were supporting the Soviet Union, and that, you know, nobody likes fascists.
Mm-hmm.
It became this brief, weird moment where the liberals and the left,
yeah, there was a consensus
against the fascists. You know,
Woody Guthrie wrote some great songs about fighting World War II. You know, but I mean, that's the thing.
Could you see that happening again? Could you see that? Like, could you see the left getting behind war?
Yeah, I think you could. Well, okay. The vast pathology of the left aside.
Yes.
If we were to fight another war against global fascism, yes.
Yeah.
I think that we would see that. I mean, by saying that the U.S. sort of... By saying that the people in the U.S. viewed the war as a defensive war and a necessary war, and that a lot of the idea of the noble war is an ex post narrative put over the war,
right,
is not the same thing as saying the war was a bad war or an unjustified war, right? I mean, quite frankly, of all the wars the U.S. has fought, World War II was the war. I mean, was the good war.
The necessary sacrifice.
Right. It was a legitimate war. I mean, we had to fight global fascism for us to be on the right side of it,
yeah,
right? Which is not shouldn't be overlooked. but that it was a war that we had to fight and we did fight, and the world is ultimately a better place because mm-hmm. we fought it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think that that was generally understood at the time.
Yeah.
Although that took a long time to develop.
So I'm reading it backwards, I guess, is what you're saying. Is that I'm looking at like World War II as the as a war to make the world safe for capitalism. I look at World War II as the moment in which the United States kind of took control of the world situation and drove it towards globalization.
Well, I mean, to make that argument, you also have to go back to the First World War, and like the 20 years in between the two wars was this sort of, you know, place where there was no clear global order, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the British dominance had disintegrated after World War One. Like, the British did not come out of that war very healthy.
Right.
And you can actually, a lot of Chamberlain's appeasement that he's playing for can be attributed to the fact that the British simply did not have the resources, even in the mid-30s, to actually carry on any kind of war with the Germans. I mean,
so it seems like that interwar period is really important. Can you talk about that a little bit of like what was going on? And I mean, globally, because and here in the United States, because it seems like World War II and the Great Depression are like always connected as this story, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, rightfully so.
And that's what I'm getting at is that there were kind of like those 20 years between the two wars were kind of a moment to like consider this kind of wider economic crisis that was happening.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So World War One happens at the end of a global golden age that starts in roughly the 1870s, and you can even attribute it to some extent to the gold standard.
Golden age for like industrial development.
Yeah, economic development.
Yeah.
Globally.
Not a golden age for people at the bottom of that ladder.
Well, even so,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm most familiar with the U.S., but wages were definitely increasing in the mm-hmm. U.S. I mean, very clearly, you would not have had the kind of massive immigration into the U.S. that we had
right.
over that period without some clear reason for it,
yeah.
right? You know, you don't leave Europe to come to the U.S. unless you think there's a good reason for it.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so, but then, you know, there's all these tensions between the Germans and the British. Just sort of general powers, but mostly I think it's characterized by the tensions between the German and the British, where the Germans and the British are sort of vying for control,
mm-hmm.
You know, who's going to be the dominant power, right? So that plunges us into World War One. World War One really zaps the strength of Europe in general. Then we have the Treaty of Versailles, which was ridiculous.
Yes.
Right?
And why? Can you explain why the Treaty of Versailles was ridiculous?
Well, the Treaty of Versailles basically told the Germans that they had to pay a bunch of money that mm-hmm. there was no way they could ever pay.
Mm.
Right?
Like, isn't that what is going on right now with globalization? I mean, isn't that what like a kind of similar situation?
Well, I have a different attitude towards globalization.
Uh-huh.
In that I do genuinely believe that trade itself
mm-hmm.
only takes place if it's...
I guess I'm just talking about third world countries being like having to like kind of being forced to take on debt in order to industrialize,
well,
and then owing like a crippling amount of money that like destroys their inner economies and their social and political structures. Like that's what happened in Germany in the interwar period. And obviously, there are different forces that are creating that.
Right. It's also reminiscent of what's going on in austerity ravaged countries like Greece. Right.
Right.
Now,
right.
Fascism rises. When your country,
you're talking about the Golden Dawn party,
exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. That when economies crash, that's when the guns come out. Is that right?
Well, not always, but I mean, I think that's reasonable. I mean,
yeah.
I think that the Great Depression led to World War II in a very clear way.
Mm.
Like, it's obvious why those two things happened at the same time.
Mm.
And that you know.
But they didn't happen at the same time because it seems like there's a. Well, I mean, they did, but there's a long period of the Great Depression where World War II is not really on the American radar, right?
No, not on the American radar, but you have to
remember
the 30s.
If it starts in 1939, yeah.
I think Hitler comes to power in 1932.
Yeah.
He comes to power in 32,
mm-hmm.
and he launches his invasion of Poland in 39.
And 32 is about where FDR is elected, right?
He's elected in 32.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get the, so, you know, there's a process of getting out of the Depression in order to rearm.
Right. Right,
which the Germans did faster and more successfully than everyone else.
Right.
I mean, the U.S. would have been able to do it, too, but they didn't want to. The French and the English have a really hard time of digging out of the hole, the economic hole that's been sort of dug for them
during
World War One, and then the Depression just sort of makes the problem worse.
Mm.
And so
it's not just American Great Depression. It's kind of a global depression.
That's the thing about the Great Depression is that the Great Depression was a global crisis. In which all of these sort of intertwining financial issues sort of all made them all worse, right? So, for instance, the big break in 32 in the U.S., the thing that really, really just causes the U.S. to go, you can mark as the place where the U.S. really starts to collapse,
mm-hmm.
Is the central, is the biggest bank in Austria
under. Right. So, it's already like a deeply interconnected global economy at that point.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's deeply interconnected, not least of which because of the gold standard.
Yeah.
But what emerges out of Versailles is this, a way of dealing with Versailles towards in the mid to late 30s is what's known as, I believe it's known as the Dawes Plan, which is this sort of not great idea.
Yeah, I've heard of the Dawes Plan.
Yeah, it's this not great idea where the U.S. is going to loan Germany the money that they need to get their economy back on good footing,
mm-hmm.
so that they can pay the British back.
Right.
But most importantly,
yeah,
because the British needs to pay the U.S. back its war debt.
Jesus.
Which the U.S. Political system is not willing to let go.
Okay.
Because whatever. Like, there's a lot of resentment for the against the British over this period because so there's sort of this. What's supposed to be this virtuous circle of the U.S. loans Germany the money to get back on their feet so that they can pay the British back,
right.
The British can pay the U.S. back, and it's supposed to be this circular system, right? But that is, 1928, that starts to crumble.
Right.
And that's actually when Germany starts to go off of an economic cliff.
Mm.
It goes off an economic cliff before the rest of the globe.
So I guess I'm interested in the connection between the economic collapse and the gearing up for war and revolution because as I tell my students and maybe I'm being completely like an inaccurate fear monger when I say this, but we're in a global depression or a global economic shock right now. So Andy, from an economic perspective. Do you see any comparison between the pre-World War II situation and the situation we're in right now? Are we heading towards World War III? How apocalyptic can we get?
No, I actually think that in Europe, actually,
What I'm suggesting is the situation is ripe for the rise of a Cobra Commander or a similar force.
It seems like if Cobra Commander does come to power, it will be in Greece first.
Mm.
In Europe, for instance, in Spain, they have like a 25% unemployment rate.
Right.
Right. That is Great Depression level unemployment.
Yeah. Rate. Yeah.
It's not entirely clear, though.
Inflation? Is inflation happening?
Well, during the Great Depression, it was that would be characterized as deflation.
Mm.
Right. Which is a falling prices, which then actually causes more harm to the economy because
right.
people start to hoard money because money increases in value without doing anything.
Mm.
Right. Or people put off purchases, right? Like, why would I buy that washing machine when it's $500?
Right.
If there's deflation, well, maybe I'll buy it when it's $400.
Yeah.
Oh, now it's $400. Well, maybe it'll be $300. That's just a way of, quick way of illustrating deflation.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I think in the Eurozone, we're seeing deflation. And quite frankly, that's the plan,
mm-hmm.
right? The plan is to cause wage deflation.
Right.
And the way you cause wage deflation is you make as many people unemployed as you possibly can.
When you say the plan, I ask whose plan? The shadowy Illuminati that run everything?
No, the idiots who run the Eurozone.
Right.
Like,
okay.
It doesn't.
I'm more comfortable with idiots.
I'm way less comfortable with idiots.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because presumably the
Illuminati... I would prefer the Illuminati.
Presumably the Illuminati is working in their own interest, right?
Right, right.
What's interesting is we're not seeing the kind of political reaction to the crisis in 2008 that we saw during the Great Depression.
Right.
I mean, I'm most comfortable talking about the U.S., but like very clearly in the U.S., we have not seen that rise because the
you're talking about like we haven't seen a New Deal.
We haven't seen a New Deal. We haven't. I mean, look, the New Deal was not necessarily just a, you know, from Roosevelt, right?
Yeah.
Like. It was to deal with massive labor unrest, riots, like tons of riots, violence, all kinds of.
So you understand the New Deal as kind of like a patch to keep capitalism going.
Well, actually, I view the New Deal primarily as kind of point. Like it didn't do anything that it was supposed to do. I mean, it did directly. In some ways, it did reduce unemployment directly through the.
I have a CCC documentary for you to watch, and then you tell me that the New Deal didn't do anything, my friend, because that built men is what that program did.
I'm actually fine with that, but as sort of a widespread industrial and agricultural policy,
yes,
it failed.
Yeah, the story that I tell my students about World War II and the Great Depression is that, and the New Deal is that the New Deal as amazing and significant as the project of the New Deal was, it didn't end the Great Depression. World War II ended the Great Depression.
Yeah,
the mobilization for war. And so tell me if I'm wrong here. Is this scenario wrong? That after World War II, the United States basically the powers that be in the U.S. government and within capitalism, they kind of recognize that. That level of production that the war created is what lifted the U.S. out of that depression, and that level of production had to be continued. And that's what the Suburban Project ended up being about.
Yeah.
Is that too general? Does that flatten it out too much?
I think that underestimates market forces, honestly. Like, I think that one... The war was not really that well centrally planned.
Right.
And that the real success of war mobilization was the fact that the government essentially guaranteed firms, particularly corporations, right?
Yeah.
Just a quick statistic, right? General Motors, I think, got something like 8% of all war spending.
Jesus.
Right. But that they...
I don't even know if Halliburton got that much.
Well, yes, of a much smaller pot.
Yeah, right.
I think that, you know, the way the U.S. mobilized, and, you know, it has a lot to do with this sort of, you know, 1939, 1940 period where it wasn't really clear the U.S. was going to get into the war. It wasn't really clear how long it was going to last. And the way that the U.S. could sort of mobilize resources in order to eventually fight the war, right, was for them to just sort of make it so that corporations and... It was corporations.
Yeah.
I don't want to say corporations because then, you know, whatever. It's a dirty word, but
yeah.
I would normally be inclined to say firms. But really, make sure corporations don't bear any of the risk of wartime production. And so, you know, sort of there was a lot of what was known as cost-plus contracts where they were like, we will pay you your costs and plus, you know, whatever, 7-8% profit.
Right.
Right. And that is really what... The engine that got the war going, right, was the willingness to pay firms, pay corporations, more, you know, to just take all the risk away.
Right, right.
Right. But that's not nefarious necessarily.
Yeah.
Right. Because part of the problem with the Depression is, and part of the problem we're facing now is, why would you start a business in a recession?
Right.
Right. And so sort of removing that layer of risk actually... helped.
Yeah.
It helped a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, rightfully so. Why would a firm want to invest in building a munitions plant if, like, oh, the war is going to be over in a year.
Right.
And they're not going to recoup their costs.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And so, you know, the market actually, I think, played a really big... And again, it's a capitalist economy.
Yeah.
You want to mobilize the resources of a capitalist economy. What do? You get the capitalists moving, and you get them moving by promising them profits.
Mm.
Right? And after the war, it's a different story, right? After the war, people had sat through the war for, you know, what, 3 or 4 years? Well, 4 or 5 years. And they had accumulated these huge, you know, bank accounts.
Right.
They had, and it was time. It was time to move forward, right? Mm-hmm. We had won. And it was time to move forward. Mm. And so demand plays really, sort of average household demand plays a really important role in pushing, you know, suburbanization forward.
And then those baby boomers, led, I've heard you talk about this before, because those baby boomers then live this like incredible period of time, right? Like the baby boomers in this post-war generation, the immediate post-war generation, I guess, like our grandparents or our parents or somewhere in between there, live in a world that that is a different world than we live in today. And they have a standard of living and an expectation that surpasses pretty much any moment in human history. But now we're kind of living on it seems like we're on the downslope of that. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that.
Like, thanks, boomers. You ate it all up. You took everything for yourselves, and we get nothing.
But I also think you can tell the same story about the 20s generation, right? Like, the 20s generation.
The Gatsby generation?
The Gatsby generation, yeah. Right? I mean, quite frankly, you know, the 2000s were the last hurrah of the baby boomer generation.
So you're saying it's not... I'm looking at, like, one giant cycle, but you're saying it's, like, cycle after cycle after cycle of this, in a sense.
I mean, I just feel like if... This, we're in the middle of the Depression, right? So what, see, it's 2013, so if we were 5 years into the Depression, right?
Right.
We were, you know, this was 1935, 1937.
Yes.
We'd be having the same complaints, right?
Right.
Like, why did this generation get to live high on the hog, and now we are all sort of, you know, coming of age,
From another perspective, I think a lot of people would say, well, we get to have, like, the internet and iPhones. It's not like we live in the despair just yet. I think I'm kind of projecting a lot forward in terms of the suburban project. What I call the suburban project is really just a kind of larger kind of post-war consumer project, and not necessarily located in the suburbs exclusively, but I think there is kind of a global awareness that can't be sustainable. That lifestyle can't be for everybody. We're not all going to get the house and the car, and we can't. Like it can't keep going forever. Like World War II, in a weird way, kind of delivered us to this moment that is incredibly entitled. It's a weird kind of thing. It's like we won World War II, and therefore we have the right to kind of eat up the resources. Am I making too many weird connections there?
I think the one thing
bitter about World War II?
I would give you a hard time about it. Is that for the developed, what we call the developed world today?
Yes,
it was not just about the victors, right? So by until very recently, right, the number two and three economies in the world were the German and Japanese economy,
right?
Right. I mean, they saw the same tremendous growth. I mean, it was, you know, we've talked about the developed world in particular.
Well, that's because we like beat them and took them over,
sort of.
Yeah, and made them and made them weird kind of capitalist clients.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like Germany, you know, had it was the idea of capitalist or industrial production was a new concept,
right?
For
either
of these countries.
Yeah,
I mean, more, it was a slightly newer to the Japanese.
It wasn't colonization,
right? It wasn't colonization. Yeah. I mean, it was we rebuilt, in particular in Germany.
It was like a kind of thuggish convincing, you know, kind of like, hey, you know, did you notice how we burned your whole country down? How about we help you build some factories?
Well, actually, the German rebound was relatively rapid because the U.S. had really not done that much damage. I mean, a significant amount of damage, but it was largely munitions factories.
Yeah.
So that after the war, the Germans still had quite a bit of consumer infrastructure left.
It's true. We'll probably never see another military adventure like World War II in the same military way, right? Like,
no.
If we saw World War III, you know, God forbid. I mean, it wouldn't be fought the same way, right? It'd be fought the way Robin is right now.
Well,
if Robin is fighting the war right now, pressing on the iPhone.
Boom.
Yeah. Nice.
if we saw,
I like how you destroyed that village in Pakistan. That was a nice move.
I think if we saw a global war, we would see, it would work a lot like World War III. But it does seem like we live in an age now where warfare is very different, in that there are no longer giant wars between armies.
Well, there's also just like the kind of stuff that's going on in like in Turkey right now, right? It's like you have revolution. I mean you have kind of like it's not like lining up different state forces in trenches. It's instead like people versus people and people versus states and people versus right. private police and a much more disparate kind of violence.
Well, it's states versus non-states.
Yeah,
right. It's
yeah.
not state versus state anymore.
Yeah, right, right.
I mean,
that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, right.
In the Iraq War,
like we don't go to war with states anymore. Right. We go to war with ideas.
Well, when we do go to war with states, we crush them in 10 minutes, right?
Yeah,
that's what happened in the Iraq War. We crushed the state in 10 minutes.
The Iraq War wasn't like it's not like people will be telling dramatic stories of the battles of the Iraq War.
Actually,
or will they?
Particularly in the first Gulf War, one of the
Catherine Hardwicke could do it. She could make it happen.
One of the big things to talk about on your history channels. Is the tank battles of the first Gulf War.
Right.
Where basically...
Is this like the road to Kuwait stuff?
Yeah, basically yeah. where like one M1 Abrams takes out 40 Iraqi tanks in 10
right.
minutes.
Right.
Because they have night vision goggles and the Iraqis are lucky to have gas in their tanks.
Yeah, this is making me want to go play Call of Duty.
Yeah.
Just talking
makes
about
me
it.
Want, it makes me want to jump in one of those World War II tanks and try to drive it.
Well, we can maybe do that. We're actually, we've talked about World War II for a while now. Did I miss anything? I mean, you brought, as usual, my guests always bring a lot of notes and we never end up talking about it because I end up just throwing ridiculous notions at you and seeing what you think about them.
Oh no!
Is there anything that you wanted to mention about World War II that I missed?
No, I don't think so. My notes were mostly numbers because I'm not very good with numbers.
Right, as says the Economist.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, Robin, Andy, thanks so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
All right,
strictly on as a sidekick.
Well, I'm hoping that maybe in a second here you can maybe like reenact the Battle of Normandy with a fart song or something like that.
I'll just bust a beatbox.
Yeah. All right. So let's go play some Call of Duty, guys. All right. Thanks a lot.